Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, offering 3 new Visa credit cards and 3 new checking accounts. WSECU's goal is to help make the right card make a difference. More information is available at WSECU.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
I remember going on to a neighborhood friend, and she had the Double Vision record by Foreigner. Neighbor,
that was really
he
cool
got me into like stuff like Kiss and Van Halen.
I remember hearing
Led Zeppelin, Whole Lot of Love. I remember hearing even the stuff when Steve Perry joined the band from Journey. So I was obviously, my brother and I were a huge fan of Journey and all that music, you know.
You're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Kevin Kniestead in for Gabriel Spitzer, and this is Steve Fournier. He's a drum instructor at the Seattle Drum School, and it's also pretty clear that he's a huge fan of 70s and 80s arena rock.
To be honest with you, really, you know, I've been kind of stuck in that era. Brings back a lot of memories growing up as a kid, and then as an adult, you go back to that time when you were a kid, when you first heard those songs or first heard that band. That's what really, I think, stuck with me.
So this music is kind of part of Steve's DNA. He's even the lead singer of a Foreigner cover band called Fever 103. And like any mega fan, when one of these bands from your favorite era comes to town, you go and see them in concert. And this was the case for Steve last fall when the band Loverboy came to play in Everett. You remember Loverboy? They made it big with songs like Working for the Weekend, Turn Me Loose, and Lovin' Every Minute of It. Lead singer Mike Reno would wear that iconic red headband. But at this particular Loverboy concert in Everett, it took kind of an odd turn almost immediately.
So Loverboy comes on, Mike Reno starts singing Notorious, and you can tell it was kind of a little bit rough. When, you know, but we're still rocking on. I'm totally singing all the lyrics and rocking out. And they finish the song, and he professes to the crowd that he just caught the flu. And, you know, he doesn't know how things are going to go, yada, yada. I'll, you know, give it my best shot. So he was only good for like two more songs after that. And that's when everything kind of came to a halt.
I guess it's, there's nothing much I can do. I can't sing anymore, so I just have to be honest with it.
And we're all just kind of sitting here in the audience going, what, you know, everybody's like, what is going on, you know? And they're like kind of chatting up there, and Mike's like, I don't know what to do. So he goes, do you mind if I bring a friend out?
We can play some music, I'll bring a friend out, is that okay?
So he actually brings this gal out on stage, and I guess it's his wife. And so he brings her out, and she goes, well, I'm not Mike Reno. I wish I was.
So I'm not Mike, but I wish I was.
So she's kind of talking and chatting with the crowd. And then she kind of basically says, well, is there a lover boy in the house? Is there anybody that can knows the songs?
Wish me luck. Got any singers out there tonight?
So the people that were around me started chanting my name, and I was like, this is just too much. I don't know what's going on. So Colin's trying to get to me, and he grabs me and he pushes me up on stage.
Somehow I think he's legit. Okay, no, he can walk around. Steve? All right, Steve. This is your moment.
So the next thing you know, she hands me a mic, and you know, when I said this is for Mike Reno, he came out and took his headband off and puts it on my head, and I'm like thinking, what is this, like, really happening? You know, it was just so crazy. I was like, all right, well, here it goes, do or die. So I sing Turn Me Loose.
Steve Steve didn't just sing, he freaking killed it, and the audience went crazy. For a guy like Steve, this is the ultimate fan dream. And that's our theme today, Biggest Fan. We'll hear how nerdiness and burlesque are pairing up, and a fan letter that finally gets sent after 2 decades in the making. And what happened to that iconic red headband that Mike Reno placed on Steve's head on stage?
I kept it. Of course, washed it.
Honestly, what I was thinking about after that happened, I'm like, oh man, I hope I don't get the flu. And if I do, it's effing worth it, man. All the way.
So most people have at least one movie that hits you like a bolt of lightning, and you'd be willing to pay and go see it in a theater again and again and again. This is something that Seattle actor and writer Barbie Beckett experienced when she was 16 growing up in El Paso, Texas. The movie that rocked her suburban world was Amadeus.
It was absolutely an escape and an immersion in something rich and decadent. I went probably, 2 to 3 times a week. So I saw it easily more than 10 times.
Remember this one? It came out in 1984. It was about two real composers, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart and Antonio Salieri, and their relationship, which probably didn't exist in real life, but it did in this movie.
Tom Hulce played Mozart, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, and I thought he was adorable. And his portrayal was extremely wacky, silly, irreverent.
Here, everything goes backwards. People walk backwards and dance backwards and sing backwards and even talk backwards.
And F. Murray Abraham played Salieri, Antonio Salieri. Salieri has this envy and jealousy of Mozart. And he feels as if he has been given this desire by God to make music, but that he's not been given the gift to make the music that Mozart can make.
All I ever wanted was to sing to God. He gave me that longing and then made me mute. Why?
And he has a beef with God about that. I loved that because I had some beefs with God myself. My home life and my family life was fairly tragic because, you know, I had siblings that were struggling with addiction, incarcerated, and there wasn't a lot of expectation or support for me because the standard, I guess, had been set. I was not a good student. Probably if I were in a different place in time, like now, I would have been diagnosed with learning differences, but at that place in time, I was just tracked and there wasn't a lot of hope. So the first time that Salieri is meeting Mozart, it's when Mozart is invited to meet the emperor that for whom Salieri is the court composer. And for this event, Salieri writes a little ditty, I don't know what you'd call it, for Mozart's entrance into the room. And the emperor asks if he may play it, and Salieri is honored. The emperor has no musical gifts at all. He can play some notes, but he has no sense of music. And he's kind of pounding out this little piece that Salieri has written as Mozart's walking in. They meet Mozart, and Mozart asks if he can play it. He presents him with his music, and Mozart says, "I don't need it. It's already all in my head." And they're incredulous, so they ask him to sit down at the piano and show them, and he plays the whole thing beginning to end. No problem. But he gets to a part towards the end where he's like, "That's not quite right, is it?" And kind of starts tweaking it.
Better? What do you think?
And within 15 seconds, it becomes this much deeper, grander, much more interesting, fun piece of music. And you just watch Salieri fade as this is happening, where he just went from being so proud that this guy is playing his music to just completely diminished by how much better he made it without thinking about it. I also related to Salieri because of the mediocrity piece. What does it take to really shine? And knowing that I had some skills, but I tended to plateau and considered that mediocrity. Not knowing at the time that sometimes you just need extra support and study, and you excel beyond those plateaus. The Academy Awards happened, and F. Murray Abraham, who played Salieri, won the award for Best Actor. And I didn't know this at the time, but the following day, with local news, I discovered that he was raised where I was raised. He was from El Paso, Texas. From a young age, I didn't ever want to be a fan. I wanted to be a peer. And when I learned that F. Murray Abraham had been raised in El Paso, and I felt like suddenly we had a connection, I wanted to deepen that connection. I wanted to shrink the gap further between me and this bigger thing that had such an impact on my life. So I figured, well, if he was raised here, his parents are probably still here. And back then we had telephone books. So I opened the white pages and looked up Abraham and found an F. And sure enough, it was his dad. And I called, and I believe I spoke to his mom. And I just told her that I was writing an article for my high school newspaper and wondered if I could come over and interview them. I didn't even know if my high school had a newspaper. I wasn't an academic student by any stretch. And she was so gracious. She didn't hesitate, and she just said yes. The house was filled with balloons and flowers and all kinds of celebratory congratulations all over the place. I hadn't really thought about how exciting it was for them that their son won an Oscar. And we just talked for at least 2 hours. They were so warm and kind and easy. It was very comfortable to hang out with them. And mostly it was Mr. Abraham that was talking to me. He had lost a son, and that still made him really emotional. He brought it up, and then he said he didn't want to talk about it. And of course, I understood that. But I was touched that he had let me into that delicate place. His mom shared more with me about her experience of watching her son have this success. And she told me that she had seen the film many times as well. And at one viewing, the two women in front of her were talking about that Salieri was so amazing. And she just was bubbling with pride, and she leaned forward and she said, "That's my son." And I just loved that she did that, you know. And then the three of them got to have this, you know, moment of connection. And just for her to get to be able to be the fly on the wall, hearing people talk about your child in glowing terms, is such a gift. She was so proud. And I think that was something I was missing. The idea of somebody bragging about you, I hadn't experienced that. And it was no longer a ruse about writing some article. I had real work to do, because I needed to start plotting how I was going to make them my grandparents before I left that place. there was no casual way to propose to them, propose that they be my grandparents, and graciously took my leave.
Barbie Beckett is an actor and writer who lives in Seattle. F. Murray Abraham's parents never did ask Barbie for the article she said she was going to write for her school paper. And there's an epilogue to this story. Years after her time with F. Murray Abraham's parents, Barbie was studying acting in Seattle when one morning she had another encounter that brought her closer to the movie Amadeus.
I was in a coffee shop one morning, kind of finishing up, and I walked out and I was at a crosswalk, and on the other side of the street, opposite me on the crosswalk, I saw somebody who looked a lot like Tom Hulce, who played Mozart. And I realized that is Tom Hulce. And then it was time to cross the street, and we just passed each other. And I wished that he could know how much he touched my life at that time. But of course, it's too much to try to communicate on a crosswalk.
That story was produced by Sound Effects' Jennifer Wing. It's Sound Effect from 88.5. I'm Kevin Kniestad in today for Gabriel Spitzer. And our theme is Biggest Fan. The devotion of fans takes many forms. A Sonics poster on the wall, a Macklemore haircut, a hand-knit Doctor Who tea cozy with rhinestones. But hardcore fans of a certain stripe have been really pushing this lately in the Northwest into a realm that is decidedly PG-13. Contributor Dyer Oxley takes us there.
What you are hearing is hundreds of Potterheads crammed into the Rio Theater in Vancouver, BC. That's Potterheads, extreme fans of Harry Potter. It's for a celebration. See, it's July 31st. Harry Potter's birthday. It's why you hear all these noisemakers. But this celebration is a little bit different. The performance tonight is a series of sketches and dances, all set to music. It starts out with a sketch about Hedwig, Harry's owl. The part of Hedwig is performed by Jane Fondue. She's dressed in an owl costume, ready to deliver a letter, dancing around Harry, who seems oblivious. And then things change. The dance is a bit of a tease, seductive, tells a bit of a story. And let's just say that Hedwig loses some feathers, and then loses a few more. If you want to know what happens after that, well, you're going to have to just buy a ticket. Harry Potter's birthday is a product of Vancouver, BC's The Geekenders. It's a theater troupe that produces musicals, some dinner theater, and shows like this, Harry Potter Nerdlesque. That's a burlesque show for nerds. And just a fair warning here, if you ever do attend Harry Potter's birthday party, you're never going to look at Dumbledore the same way again.
I have always loved Professor Umbridge.
This is Erin Walker. She's one of the producers of the show.
I just love the way her character is written, and I just love how evil she is and how as soon as you step on stage, everybody boos you, and it feels so good.
Why?
Just because I love playing the ugly and the funny character because it's a lot more fun than playing the ingenue. You get to explore weird things and embrace the weird things about you.
Erin is behind this Harry Potter Nerdlesque show. She performs in it, though on stage she's known by her burlesque name.
My burlesque performance name is Kitty Glitter. She is all about, well, glitter of course, and comedy routines and being raunchy. And just trying to make everything as fun and outrageous as she can.
This Harry Potter Nerdlesque performance is actually part of a stable of shows the Geekenders produce.
We've done a Jurassic parody, the musical, in which I was a Velocitapper. So cute. Our Batman burlesque was really popular. Our Lord of the Schwings. And we've got a Shakespeare burlesque coming up. the Star Wars Burlesque is probably one of our most popular shows. We've done The Empire Strips Back, A Nude Hope, Reveal of the Jedi. I know that's not in order. Sorry, nerds. and then we also did a parody of The Force is Shaken as well.
The shows sell out. The Harry Potter show at the Rio was a packed house. You see, there has been this resurgence in the burlesque scene. Along with this renewed interest in burlesque has come nerdlesque, which has grown quite popular in the Northwest. Shows are selling out from Vancouver, BC, down to Portland. But just like this Harry Potter show, nerdlesque might not be what you may expect. In mainstream society, nerds and sexuality don't often get mentioned in the same sentence or even the same conversation. Then again, it's also not common to pair a bustier and fishnets with a stormtrooper helmet, or see Game of Thrones depicted as, well, actually pretty similar to the show, but with great backing music. These nerdlesque productions aim to change that perception. Body positivity is a common theme, and there's a lot more layers to it than the sensational aspect burlesque has become known for. And for that part of the story, we turn to Seattle's JoJo Stiletto.
Burlesque can sort of incorporate aspects of a lot of different art forms: ballet, jazz, dance, mime, clowning, theater, telling a story, but is an art form for people who are not afraid to use their entire body to tell a story.
JoJo Stiletto has been a burlesque performer, but also produces a lot of nerdlesque shows in Seattle. And therefore, she gets to be known by this really cool name.
JoJo Stiletto, the professor of nerdlesque.
To understand this unique take on burlesque, it's actually quite helpful to go back and understand where it came from back in the mid-1800s.
Lydia Thompson and her British Blondes helped found American burlesque. They were women being very scandalous, which meant that they were like wearing trousers. And they were doing things that really women didn't do on stages, as they were speaking, which was very, you know, that women had a certain role in the theater at that time. And they were mixing in like song and dance, and they were actually sort of mocking modern politics. I say that what we're doing today has sort of taken burlesque back to its pop culture roots, this original idea of satire and parody.
And JoJo thinks it was right around 2010 when a lot of modern pop culture started to blend into traditional burlesque acts. And all through this time, JoJo was producing shows of her own. Like there was a Whedon-esque burlesque show in Seattle. It was based on the fandom of Joss Whedon.
There was a show based on the work of Image Comics, specifically Image Comics. Cards Against Humanity, I said earlier, like everything. In the Northwest, you know, there's so much happening here. We have PAX, we have Emerald City Comic Con, we are a tech boom city. And that kind of translates down to Portland and Vancouver as well. Like, we love our nerd. We're the indoor kids. So we've got sort of like a loose network of producers producing troupes in the Pacific Northwest. There were so many shows in Seattle one summer, we literally called it the Summer of Nerdlesque. It was like every weekend there was a nerdy burlesque show to go see, and it was all done by different producers.
The Geekenders up in Vancouver, BC, they've grown to be a lot like other nerdlesque troupes in the region. There is the performance, but there are a lot of these other issues that the community is founded on. And this is something I ran into a lot when speaking about this. For example, it's why Kitty Glitter has become such an active member in this nerdlesque scene.
I think it's a really great way for people to express themselves and gain confidence. For me, being a plus-size girl, I've never felt sexier in my life. And make people laugh and feel sexy and take off my clothes in the meantime.
Be sexual in a way that you control, which I think is very powerful and oddly not inherent in how we're supposed to interact with the world. And I think that that's why people maybe don't understand that burlesque is a feminist art form. And it's a space where consent is inherently necessary.
All of that adds up to those layers I mentioned before. Some of it is theater. Some of it is a statement on society or politics, and some of it is just simply a laugh, playing on inside jokes that only nerds get.
And so you can see an act about Wonder Woman who's sort of exploring her sexuality that isn't necessarily straight. You can see an act where a performer is actively talking about what the effects of getting harassed while playing Dungeons and Dragons has had on her. And in that meeting, it's also important to say, like, you know what helped people kind of learn something today was that they had fun while they were doing it.
That story from Dyer Oxley, who writes at mynorthwest.com, a version of the story originally appeared on the podcast Northwest Nerd. You're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Kevin Kniestead in for Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is Biggest Fan. If the 700,000 fans that showed up for the parade after the Seahawks won the Super Bowl was any indication, Seattle loves its sports teams. But Lauren Sandretsky, who might be better known as Big Low, may just be Seattle's biggest sports fan. At times, he's even carried business cards with that as the job title. If you've ever watched a Seahawks game on TV and seen someone holding the Sea Fence sign in the stands, well, he came up with that. But for Big Low, fandom helps him get through a life filled with challenges. He spoke with Sound Effect's Gabriel Spitzer, and a warning, this conversation has a brief graphic reference to a violent act that some might find disturbing.
Mom dying was the hardest. She fought cancer for 6 of my 7 years. And to watch the emotional side of what she went through, her cry, her tears, her crying, her anger, there was so many different emotions from my mother. Well, Grandpa died before Mom, and Grandpa was my buddy. Well, you know, it's just like I've lost 2 people in my life that matter a whole lot to me. You know, Mom's mom, that was Grandma Gilmore, and I loved her to death, you know. She took care of me after Mom passed, and my Aunt Sherry did. And unfortunately, when I was in my teens, she came up missing, and they found her head in the woods. And Sherry, Sherry was one of the most spiritual women I'd ever met on this planet. I mean, she loved God, and I don't know. It's something that I carried with me for years and years.
So at that time, before sports became really central to your life, how did you cope with those losses and those emotions?
What really turned me around was you know, working in the clubs.
This is an adult entertainment establishment.
Exactly. Meeting the players that I met. You know, Dennis Rodman comes in when I was working down on First Avenue, First and Pike, Deja Vu. And Dennis comes in and I was like, holy crap, you're Dennis Rodman. He's like, I am? I was like, dude, yes, you are. He ended up standing there BSing with me for about 45 minutes at the door. I said to him, I said, you know, hey, can I maybe get some tickets for the game? And he was like, sure. And boy, did that ignite a fire, because I didn't miss a Sonics game after that. I just wanted to be there all the time, whether it be sitting upstairs, downstairs. I didn't care where I was as long as I was inside that arena.
Wow. So as you're sort of making that transition to, like, you know, enormous fan, you had some health setbacks, right? What happened?
The first health battle was 1999. I contracted a virus that was relatively new to everybody called necrotizing fasciitis, and it's a flesh-eating bacteria. I kind of felt this thing pinching in my upper groin area. Well, then it grew from like the size of a peanut to the size of a lime to the size of a lemon to the size of an orange, and in the course of 5 days, it was the size of a grapefruit. And the pain was so bad, I called a buddy and said, dude, you got to drive me to the hospital. Went over to Highline Hospital. They shipped me down to Harborview, where a bunch of doctors came in, looked at my infection, and they all turned white. And were like, what the heck is that? But these guys got to work on me right away. And I went through 3 surgeries in 5 days. I was in ICU for 7 in the burn unit because I had such a big open wound. And the doctors came in, and my main surgeon, Dr. Engrav, had said, you aren't going to be out here for 2 or 4 more months. It was tough. It was definitely made life interesting at that point.
Yeah. How close a call do you think that turned out to be?
Doctor said 6 more hours, I wouldn't have been here.
If you had waited 6 hours to go in?
Yeah.
Wow.
And so had to have people come in to learn how to do the wound changes because they have to dress you and like do the wet to dry wound changes. And so we had to do that twice a day for, God, it was almost 9 months.
Wow.
And, you know, I mean, that's one of the hardest recoveries I've ever had.
Were you able to work and do stuff during that time?
No. After going through all that, you know, I got really depressed and just, you know, we ended up divorced. The big blow to me was 2005, the action figure came out. And
come again?
You didn't know Bigelow had a Superfan action figure?
Tell me about the Bigelow Superfan action figure.
Wow, holy smokes. Well, I am one sports fan. I believe to be the only sports fan on the planet with his own action figure. Mark Paulo said, we're thinking about doing a fan-based action figure and we want to use your image. I said, do I get paid? And he said, yeah. I said, where do I sign? So, you know, that was huge. And it was a very exciting time because at the time, the Seahawks were hot. And that was the year they went to the Super Bowl.
Did it look like you to you?
I think it does. I mean, when I was fatter, yeah, definitely. Doesn't look like me so much now because I'm a little thinner, more stealth.
So that was a good, positive experience by and large.
Yeah.
So can you talk about what it was like to go from being a sports fan to being a super fan, a little bit above and beyond, you know, the normal civilian fans?
I don't remember when I started doing the airport thing.
And what do you mean by that? What's the airport thing?
Well, everybody called me a stalker. I'd go down and I'd see the boys off when the Sonics would leave and when they'd come back. I'd be there at the airport and I'd get the doors for them. And heck, there was times when it'd snow out and I'd shovel paths to all their cars. And, you know, I mean, I didn't want my guys on my favorite team to break an ankle trying to get to their car after a road trip. And so I did those little extra things when they were in the finals in 96. This is corny. I went to the local locksmith and I said, hey, dude, you got a cool key that's got a nice faceplate that I could put the words win on? He's like, what? I said, I just want keys that have etched on them win. Sure. 2 weeks into the season, I gave every player a key. And I said, this is the key to the championship. And every key said win. At the end of the season, when the boys were in the playoffs, 9 of the players on the court and 2 of the coaches had those things hanging from their rearview mirrors. And so that was probably one of the coolest dorky fan things that I've ever done. But, you know, I mean, you know, there's people that bake them cookies. They're super fans. There's people that make them signs and artwork. They're super fans. Everybody out there is a super fan. It just matters where your heart is.
And how is being a fan and having that mindset and going to games and, you know, just being immersed in it helped you deal with your own stuff over the years?
Just the love of the fact that you've got so many different thousands of people that you're high-fiving and hugging when you're winning. You're hugging people you don't even know. Even when you're struggling, your team's having a funky time, you're still high-fiving your buddies next to you. And the fact that I know the Mariners are going to win a World Series one day, it's things like those that just, they keep me going. Right now, I got 2 bum feet. I got holes in both feet from diabetic foot ulcers. And I've got a blood clot in my head that pounds like a son of a gun 24 hours a day. It's been really miserable, but you know what? Life is what you make it. And if you make it miserable, it's going to be miserable. But I'm going to make it happy because I want to be happy. So let's go Seattle. Let's win some games.
Lauren Bigelow Sandretsky, Seattle sports fan. Thank you so much.
Thank you guys for having me in. It's been a fun time.
Lauren Sandretsky, Bigelow, speaking with Sound Effects Gabriel Spitzer. This is Sound Effect. I'm Kevin Kniestead, sitting in for Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is Biggest Fan. If you ever stayed home sick or played hooky from work, you've probably heard this theme music. That, of course, is the theme from The Price is Right, the game show where contestants compete for fabulous prizes by guessing the value of stuff. And if you've seen the show and its live studio audience, you know it has some pretty intense fans. Well, there's a family here in Washington who may top that list of fans. Three members of the Goss family have competed on The Price is Right, and all three walked away big winners. We visited them in Chehalis and found a house packed with game show loot.
The diamond ring is on my mother-in-law's hand. We have this smart luggage here, which is very complicated. It runs by an app. It's awfully pretty. It's very fancy. And then out here, here's Brett's take. There's the waterproof TV, the fire pit, and the barbecue. I'm Tina Goss, and I was on The Price is Right.
Tina Goss, come on down!
It taped on November 6th, and it aired December 19th.
My name is Brett Patrick Goss. I'm the husband of Tina Goss.
Brett Goss, come on down!
And I was on The Price is Right, my birthday, April 1st, back in 2013.
All the way from the back row.
Hi, I'm Darlene Goss. I am a relation to Brett Goss and Tina Goss. They are my son and daughter-in-law.
Darlene Goss, come on down.
I was on in January of 1972. Oh, wait, no, it wasn't two, it was 74. 1974.
1986.
Oh, wait a minute, it was 1996. At that time, my husband was at a convention for his job, Aramark, in San Diego, and I said, can I borrow your car in the morning? And he says, yes. So I drive up to LA, and when I first got in there, I thought, oh, probably fat chance I'm going to get picked because there's so many people, and I was at the very back.
It's an elegant new chandelier.
It was just, your heart was beating so fast, it was so much fun.
One of you is exactly right, you won a $100 bonus. It is the contestant who bid $825. It's Darlene. It is Darlene.
We decided to take another trip down to LA. And it was for my birthday. And I thought, I'm gonna make it on there. If my mom did, I'm gonna get on. I'm like my mom, pretty outgoing. And I knew it was gonna happen.
Actual retail price, $600. Brett, come on up here.
You run up on stage. I'm a former Marine. Drew Carey's a former Marine. So we had that in common. We started talking about that.
Separate five. Another Marine, what's going on? It's the Marine Corps, it's Marine Corps takeover day, and The Price is Right. What do you say about that?
And the next thing you know, it's a fire pit, a trip to Iceland, and a Chevy Sonic. And so I bid on it, and they go to commercial break, and I'm sweating so bad, the makeup lady comes out and goes, oh my gosh. And she's dabbing me off like I'm Elvis.
Welcome back, everybody, to The Price is Right. And the $26,107. Actual retail price, $28,252. Yes! How about that? Yes! All right. Our Marine here is the winner. $47,713 of the prize. Nice birthday.
There's preparedness, knowing the games. We watched it often enough, and when we knew we were going down, it was crunch time. It was study. We watched the pro writing down the prices, seeing consistencies, knowing. That's how we did with his, too, because that's how we knew that shuffleboard table was $600. We knew it right exactly. So preparedness, having a real good shirt, and I think having a good story, something to really engage, it's so exciting just to be on there. You're in this rush, this adrenaline rush for the whole, you know, 5, 6, 7 hours you're there.
Nice job. You just won $43,477 of the prizes on The Price is Right.
We moved around a ton. My father was in the hotel business, and so it was from different property to different property. And so there was, you know, one thing usually consistent. It was the television that had Travelodge in the side of it and The Price is Right that would come on throughout the summer months. You know, it was either watch The Price is Right or be that annoying kid that invented the game of putting all the buttons on the elevator at the same time.
You are the first four contestants on The Price is Right. And now, here is the star of The Price is Right, Bob Barker.
There's the familiarity with the music up until Drew Carey, who's been around for the last decade. It's been the same host, it's always been the same format, but it's unlike Jeopardy or a Wheel of Fortune or a lot of these other game shows that have still been around for a long time. The difference here, I think, is that excitement level that starts in the beginning and it runs throughout. There's a new contestant coming down every time, so you can kind of pick your person you like or you don't like. So it's always like a forward-moving, perpetual type of experience, I think, that people have on that show. We have two daughters, and they have a steep hill to climb because it's not like they're carrying on a tradition of West Point or Harvard or law school, but they're going to go on The Price is Right. And they're already talking about who's going on first, who's going to get on first. They're as competitive as we are, so they both watch it, and they're kind of forced to watch it now, like we were forced to watch Lawrence Welk as a kid, but they're enjoying it. Are you going to fly down again?
Oh, yeah, I'll try again. Oh, yeah, I'll be down. You bet. I got to keep my home, keep watching this show so I can keep taking my little notes so I know, you know, how much prices are and stuff like that. But, oh, yes, I plan on going back down.
Here come your friends, Bob Barker, reminding you how to control the pet population, have your pets spayed or neutered. Bye, everybody.
That story was produced by 88.5's Will James. So when we decided to do this Biggest Fan show, this voice inside my head piped up. You know you have to come clean, it said. See, there's a certain musician out there who's had a major impact on me over the decades and has come to have a place in my heart unlike anyone else. The thing is, people who know me tend to be kind of shocked by who it is. So I figured it was time for an explanation. With that, here is my audio fan letter. Dear Jewel, my name is Kevin Kniestad. I'm 38 years old. I live in Seattle, and I am your biggest fan. Close to 20 years ago, I fell in love for the first time. She was a little shy, maybe a tad awkward, and had a bit of a tough outer shell. We didn't have a lot of money to go out and do things, so our nights together often led us to a marina. We'd watch the water, we'd look at the boats, and we'd create personas for the people that we imagined lived in the fancy condos with the million-dollar views of the Sound. Exactly how you ended up there, I can't really recall, but you were there. I have to be honest, back then, your music wasn't really my cup of tea. It was more likely that you'd catch me listening to Puff Daddy or Jimmy Buffett or Dave Matthews, or pretty much anything that wasn't Jewel. But at some point, a copy of your first album, Pieces of You, made it into my car CD player, and for some reason or another, it stayed in there and ended up playing almost every night. There are only so many conversations you can have about imaginary marina residents before long periods of silence end up setting in. And there you were to fill those gaps with your music. And the more we listened to your lyrics, the more you seemed to become a part of those nights. The night I fell in love with her, you, of course, were playing in the car. We were sitting there watching the water, and she started to cry. For whatever reason, that tough outer shell had been pierced. She told me about a family member that she was really close to who had passed away far too young, and that she hadn't known how to talk to anybody about the impact that it had on her. It was the first time I had ever felt like someone had trusted me enough to be that vulnerable. This led to other nights where she shared her struggles with depression, and it was the first time I had ever thought that I might need to pay closer attention to my own mental health. And you were there. A couple years down the road, when she left me, you were there too. And as days passed and those long nights got a little shorter and a little easier, you were there too. When I got my wisdom teeth pulled, I watched the Jewel Live at Humphreys by the Bay DVD. When your Christmas album came out, you helped me enjoy the holidays. I watched you sing in the rain at Memorial Stadium and in the sun at the Gorge. I was the tall guy in the crowd, towering over a sea of mostly much shorter women, just in case you were curious. By the way, I caught up with the ex a handful of years ago and made mention that I wanted to see you again in concert. "You still listen to her?" she asked. I told her that I did. I told her about my memories of the marina and her opening up to me and how I felt like you were a part of the conversation. "Huh," she said. "I never really saw it like that. Not at all." Part of me was surprised by this, that she didn't look back at that time the same way I did. But to be honest, I also felt a little relieved. If there was one fear I always had from listening to your music for all of those years, it was that deep, deep down, this was my way of holding on to the past, that I wanted you and your music to matter as much to her as you did to me, and that would somehow give that relationship from so many years ago some form of validation. But when I heard her say that, I felt vindicated that you weren't a lingering soundtrack to a broken heart, but a friend I had made that could be easily accessed whenever I needed you, or just wanted to say hi to, regardless of what anybody else thought. No matter how much time went by, you were always nearby, like any old friend. You always seemed to look out for me, and always seemed to know just what to say. Your friend, Kevin.
Night with its shattered teeth, attempt to speak, my pen's present, but courage left via the sink, and I'm sorry I snuck up on you from behind. Sorry, not all my love letters did rhyme, and I'm sorry that Jesus died for my sins, and I swear to God, it won't happen again. And I'm sorry if it was my swerve that tempted you to sway. Oh, well, sometimes it be that way.
That'll do it for the show this week. Sound Effect is produced by Jennifer Wing and Posey Gruner. We got help this week from Will James, Dyer Oxley, and Janae Janik. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. Our podcast is widely available, and if you happen to subscribe to it on iTunes, we'd love it if you would rate and review the show there. You can find extras on Facebook. Just search KNKX Sound Effect. Gabriel Spitzer will be back in the host chair next week when our theme is Truth to Power. I'm Kevin Kniestad, and this is KNKX.